My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors He worketh steadily. Oft times He weaveth sorrow and I in foolish pride. Forget He sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly shall God unroll the canvas and explain the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. My name's Jim Lawrence, and I'm an alcoholic. Amen. God, for however many years I've stood behind these knee knockers and bowed this time, I am not going to have to open up with that poem, The Weaver. I'm not trying to impress anybody. It's just that poem speaks to my heart. If you can look at a weaver, at the loom, and the golds, and the browns, and all the colors, the mosaic of colors. And if you note it in there, and I'm not trying to impress you with reciting poetry, it says the dark threads are as needful. Now, I want to know, where in the world is there a group of people said sometimes he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Who knows what that speaks to any more than we, that are members of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen? Because sometimes we know about some dark threads. We know about some dark times. You know, our book says we trudge the happy road of destiny. Don't say nothing about hop, skipping, and jumping. Boy, I'm going to tell you, by God, anybody that told you it's easy, easy does it, and all the things you see, yeah, but easy does it, but do it. You know, I get plugged up after a while and do what I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope. And my book tells me that we tell in a general way what it was used to be like, what happened, and what it's like. I've got it down pat, all except that in a general way. Boy, I'm glad I'm a life speaker. We got a good time going. We'll get out of here sometime tonight. But now I want to give you something to think about. And this is the first time that I've ever talked under these conditions. I was just telling Bob, I've talked under, not a lot, I'm not a circuit speaker. I just talk when they ask me. But now, how many of you have got to talk and knowing that you're fixing to get up to talk in a room full of resentments? Every damn body that did not win anything, including the speaker, is full of resentment. So, you know, I got a tough road to hoe. I got a tough road to hoe. But you know, I know that we practice principles for four personalities, but this is really something for me to be standing up here. And I remember it vividly. I came to Monteagle maybe once or twice before Carol and I married, and we married in 71, and then we came, I don't know, three or four times. I don't know how many we came. But I was sitting in the meeting here at Monteagle, one of my favorites. And I'm going to tell you, I've been blessed to be exposed to some of the giants in this program, and I'm not going to start calling names, but that particular night, at the Monteagle Roundup, one of my favorites from Midland, Texas, I think he's at the big meeting now. Many of you know and remember Harold Wilson. Harold comes up to the podium and he just looked out, you know, to the group and he said, "Well," he said, "I've invited everybody that has ever had anything to do at all with this roundup to West Texas to speak at different functions, hoping that that in turn would get me here." And he said, I finally made it. Well, I'm going to tell you, it's been 40. I hadn't invited nobody nowhere to get here. I want to thank the committee, and more than likely it's the committee of one, probably Milton, that lied to the committee and told them it'd be all right to have me. And probably the real basis of that was probably a person that I love with all my heart that's sick and not here with us tonight, because I think Mickey kind of put a bug in Milton's ear and suggested, I think she was wanting to get Carolyn here. Probably thought I had to come along as excess baggage. I mean, I know the deal. I don't deny that. But you know, I want to do what I'm supposed to do, but you know, you have to sort of get into it. I call it getting plugged up. If I can get plugged up with God and he takes over and I get out of the way. You know, when I go to speak, I ask three things. I ask that I make a talk that will exemplify and bring credit. Get me out of the way and bring credit to Alcoholics Anonymous. And secondly, that I will not embarrass the person that asked me to come. You know, sometimes, you know, I might go off and come out with some off-the-wall stuff that's really not appropriate, and I apologize beforehand for that. You know, hell, I know me. But when I sit down, when it's over, that I know down here in my heart and soul and in my spirit, that I've done what I'm supposed to do, that I've been as honest as I can be, and God, I'm getting up in years, my birth certificate's wrong, there's no way that I can be what it says on there. But my forgetter's working overtime most of the time now, and so I might forget. But if I let God have it, because all I want to do, and I don't want to embellish nothing, and I don't want to over-dramatize. I just want to tell you in a manner that will make you see that the greatest thing in all the world is Alcoholics Anonymous, and Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen. God, we're so blessed. You know, I don't even need to get up here tonight. How many of you were at dinner and was sitting there when the gal sang Amazing Grace and heard that? I don't need to even say a thing. I can just say, just think about it for a minute. That song you just heard, and you heard my story. The whole deal with me, and I know the things that embody this program, but I believe the whole deal is grace. And that grace that has allowed me some years of sobriety, and that grace that's available. And I see people sometimes that I don't know, I'm not in their head and heart, but it's like that grace is available about my drinking, but God, it's available about jobs, it's available about family and wife and children and work and all of the whole picture. The whole deal, Mike, is God's grace. And I want to thank Mike for last night, and special. And Carolyn today, and I'm here to tell you, I already know what a blessing we're in store for with Percy. See, Percy and Barbara and Bob and Juanita and Milton, Joanne, and I'm not trying to be a name dropper, but, you know, a lot of the people that I was close to back in the days of Mont Eagle, or they've gone on to a big meeting tonight. Probably Hawkins, Jim, and George Montgomery's up there saying, I'll bet you how long he talks, and they're making bets. Of course, they got a meeting up there, and they're both arguing over who's going to get to chair it. But I'm going to share with you the best I can what I'm supposed to do, and grew up in a little town not far from here. I know about Mont Eagle, and I know about Mont Eagle Mountain, and I know about in the snow and the bad weather how you used to couldn't think about coming up Mont Eagle Mountain, because I grew up in a little town down at the foot towards Chattanooga and turned right on 59, and there wasn't no 59, it was old US 11 Grew up in a little town called Fort Payne, Alabama. I was the only celebrity from my hometown till a music group shot me just plumb out of the saddle. Now, I can look out here and tell that most of y'all are Mozart and Beethoven. I don't know if we've even got any country music fans. But if we have, Fort Payne is where the group Alabama is from. And that's my claim to fame. I used to, in my work in Kentucky, I'd be calling somebody in my work in another state. They'd say, your accent, you don't sound like you're from Kentucky. And I'd give them that line about Alabama, and if it's some little old girl on the other end of the line of secretary or something, she'd squeal and say, "Do you know Randy Owens?" And she just want me to fix her up with Randy. But I wasn't into that. I grew up in a home of working people. My mom and dad, they never was much industry there. There's a lot more now. And I don't know any way to give this talk. I don't know any way to talk in AA, but just reach down and try to just start going through it. And you know, I don't want to stay drunk. Sometimes I go from the womb to the tomb. And I don't want to stay drunk too long. I'd rather, and we say this and then we give a big drunkalogue, I'd rather let it get through in time to let you see how grateful I am. And you know, I go to meetings a lot and don't go to no more than I need to. Still, people say, "You still go to the meetings after this?" And I say, "I still go to the table and eat, don't I? You know, I still go get them beans and taters." So I'm just a garden variety drunk, and y'all gonna have to see that I don't even know what that word politically correct is. Where in the world do they come up with these terms? But I grew up in this home, and I grew up in a home of love and affection. But like I hear so many talking, even today, you know, not in the manner that we exhibit it sometimes to each other in Alcoholics Anonymous. People work and put food on the table and provide clothing and for in a family and whatever. And I know it's going to be difficult, as sharp as I look, to know that I was born in 1931, and they tell me 29, 30, 30, long that's something. They talk about a depression. And I don't remember doing without anything other than as a real youngster. This was very young because it was a tricycle, not a bicycle, that I really wish I could have got for Christmas, and we couldn't afford it. And I had an uncle, my dad's brother, and his wife didn't have any children, and he showed up at my house with a tricycle. Man, I remember my mother, how overwhelmed she was and how grateful that I was able to get that. And that was kind of the early beginning, but, you know, I'm into grammar school, and God just, you know, I've just always enjoyed life, I guess. I've always been a very gregarious, very outgoing, you know. I come on like gangbusters, and a lot of people don't really, a little more so than a lot of people like sometimes, but that ain't my problem, that's theirs. I come to this fellowship, you know, though a real people pleaser, and I'll get on into it. But always wanting to do whatever it took. God, before I got here, I would have laid down on the floor and let you walked on me if that's what it took for you to like me, for you to accept me, and for me to please you. And, you know, I want you to like me today, and hope you do. If you do, fine. But my happiness is the inside job, and it's my relationship with the God of my understanding. My sobriety date is March 20th, 1968. I just celebrated 40 years last month. It is almost, I can't believe it. And I say to people, I may have had 40 years of uninterrupted sobriety, but I have not had, and I want you to hear this, I have not had 40 years of uninterrupted sanity. I have just been crazy as hell probably yesterday. And that ain't no big deal. That's all right. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Boy, I like that. Oh, God. Oh, it's so wonderful not to carry the weight of the world. Oh, I'm in charge of everything. I knew everything. God, still do sometimes. Still know a lot more than some people I run into. But that's all right. I try not to tell them exactly how to do. But I grew up in this family and in the school, grammar school, and you know, all the stuff that the kids do, and I was the only child at that time. And I remember going into high school, and I know a lot of times I get talking and people wonder, well, are you ever going to take a drink? But I didn't get started. I'm not a prenatal drunk. My dad, back when I was a real youngster, my dad used to drink a little, and well, he drank a lot, and then through other means, not this fellowship, through his experience and relationship with the God of his understanding, he ceased the drinking and became real active in his religious activities. And but even into high school, see, I started to try to get this thing in some semblance. I started into high school, ninth grade, I was through city school, in 1945. I graduated from high school in 1949. So if you think back to 45, you know, there's a World War II, the war was going on, and we had some veterans that come back in 45 when I started school that had left school to go into service, military, and had come back in school. And I don't say this, I'm not here tonight to try to impress anybody about anything. I'm not trying to be the best alcoholic and the most sober, or I'm not going to try to tell you I was the worst. What you see is what you get. But I'm going to tell you, in that high school in 1945, you know, I didn't come in on a turnip truck. These guys, that they had their homebrew up in the woods out from the school, and some of them was brazen enough, they might be a half pint in their locker. And it's a pretty lusty crew. And I make jokes about the football team. They always played at night till Thanksgiving Day. They had a day game, afternoon game, and there's always, you know, under the influence and made it fine, them night games, but they didn't much know where the plays went there with that Thanksgiving Day game. But that's probably not really true. They did pretty good. But see, of all that, I don't remember, and you hear a lot today about peer pressure and that terminology, and I'm sure there is that. But I don't remember anybody begging me or twisting my arm. Or I played sports. I played basketball and baseball. I wasn't big as a minute. I weighed about 108, 112 pounds. I think when I graduated, I weighed a lusty about 126. And listen, I didn't get too many rebounds in basketball, but I like to shoot. God, get it here and let me shoot it. But see, all that going on, and especially in baseball, it wasn't anybody, and I just didn't drink. It wasn't nobody trying to beg me, Jim. Every once in a while you'd get some jokes, and, you know, they wouldn't call me a sissy, or I was a mama's boy, or why don't you drink? Well, I just didn't want it, you know. And it wasn't, you know, I was wanting to be a good athlete, and I didn't have lace on my drawers. It wasn't that I was afraid mama would catch up with me, even. It wasn't that. I just didn't want to drink. But probably my senior year in high school, and I cannot tell you. And see, I want to make this point. You know, we talk about how, and I hear this in the fellowship. I've heard it all the time about I couldn't dance. I couldn't ask the girls out. I was shy, you know, until I took that drink, you know. Man, I didn't need nothing to come on, like, oh hell, just crazy, and enjoyed life, and didn't need, so why then, you know? And I don't question this today, I don't know whatever really possessed me. I remember the first beer I ever drank was Champagne Velvet. I don't even know, it's CV. God, I thought they ought to pour it back in a horse. And you know, I hear that term a lot, you know, I ought to pour it back in a horse. And I thought a lot, you know, I analyze a lot. I don't know how something that comes out of a horse tastes. Why do we compare stuff with pour it back in the horse, you know, because it tastes like horse pee? Well, I don't know. I've never had any of that. I'd use that terminology, you know. But I didn't fall in love with the first beer I ever drank. But let me tell you, I started loving it like a hog loves slop. I mean, I love beer. I wasn't ever much of a mixed drinker. But from the time I started drinking, I embarked, I guess would be a good word. I don't get into argument about whether I was an alcoholic, born an alcoholic, or crossed over the invisible line. I think at the time I crossed over the line, I had all of the stuff in me that we see and know that maybe it's just waiting for an accident, waiting to happen or something, because I started drinking then, and it was just paramount. That's the most important thing in my life. I might not have been drinking all the time, but I was thinking about it. I was planning it. And so I got on out of high school and went to work, was living at home. I don't know. I guess my folks could have. I just never had expressed. And I made good grades, but I'd never had in mind to pursue, you know, the college and whatever. And well, I started wrecking my daddy's cars, and I started just not doing nothing but creating havoc in that home with drinking. Well, I remember one day my daddy called me in, and I talk about this. Now, I didn't get thrown out of the hell out of it. He said, well, he kicked you out. No, he didn't. He set me down one day, and we talked about my lifestyle, and that old saying about if you're going to put your feet under this table. See, I wasn't paying any rent. I'm working, making a little money, and started the life we start, living there in my parents' home. And it wasn't long after we talked about that, because he told me that's fine. If that was the kind of life I had chosen, God, you'd think he'd been to Al-Anon or something. He said that I was going to do it somewhere else. You know, I wouldn't continue to be doing it there, living there. And you know, I didn't take that as not loving me or throwing me out. It's just telling me how the cow ate the cabbage. You know, I still was getting that razor strop laid on my behind on up till I was pretty big. And I wasn't abused. God, today if a woman in a grocery store grabs a youngin' and starts to whack him, she'll be reported to the human relations there or something in that state, and kids gone, you know, because God, I never got a one I didn't need and didn't get enough. And I got them in love, and they wanted me to, you know, that old thing about be somebody. But shortly, it hadn't been long after we'd had that talk. Now we're looking at 1950, Korean War was on, and got me a cap today because Percy got one and I saw it because I'm a veteran of the Korean War, and I've never seen that cap that he saw. And Lord, it just captured me, and I went down to that Army store and I've got me one. I can't wait to get back to Lexington, put it on. And I never talked much about that time of my service that I was in from, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but 50 to 54, that's where I was in the Navy. But I just knew we had what they call the draft. See, God, I'm dating how old I am. Well, I'm just going to tell you, and this is unbelievable. I'll be 77 years old in September. There ain't no damn... There ain't no way I can be that old. I used to tell my mama, I wish you'd go to Montgomery and get my birth certificate straightened out. And she died at 95. And I guess I begin to think, hey, maybe my birth certificate's right. But I just knew that I was going to be drafted. I'd reached that age, you know. And I told my daddy one day, now listen to this. I don't know this. My daddy's somewhere else tonight, but he's probably watching this because he loved this program. He loved AA. I've never seen anybody that loved it anymore to not know anything about it. But he saw what could happen and what happened to his son. But I told my dad, now Fort Payne's not a little old hick town, but we didn't have the recruiting office full time every day. Didn't have a lot of things every day. But I said, let's drive down to Gadsden. Gadsden, Alabama is 45 minutes from Fort Payne. And I said, let's drive down to Gadsden, and I believe I want to inquire. Now, I'm going to inquire about the Navy, the Air Force, certainly not the soldier, not the infantry, and not the Marines, but maybe the Air Force. I want to just get some information. I don't know this, but I believe if I could relate back and remember, I bet he raced to the car. God, I imagine he just was sitting there under the wheel ready. God, oh Lord, if you're going to get him out of here, thank you. I go out, we get in the car. Now listen, this is me. I'm going to sum me up pretty good in a minute. We go to Gadsden Park. I go in. Now I'm going in to find out about what you do, and there's all sorts of deals, you know, they got, you know, for enlist and go later and all. But anyway, this is 1950, October 1950. And I'm in there about 40, 45 minutes, and I come back out and get in the car. Now listen, he says, what'd you find out? I said, I'll leave in the morning. That's a story of my life on anything, and still is today, that impulsive car. He said, what'd you find out? And I said, I'll leave in the morning. Now a lot of people said they really conned me, but what they was telling me, there was two billets left, call them billets. Now I know what y'all think, he's dumber than dirt, but I know I had two billets. I could go to Great Lakes to boot camp. Or if I didn't go in the morning, if I didn't go now, the next deal goes to San Diego, California for boot camp. Now, don't tell me I don't know how long it takes you to get from Great Lakes, Illinois, back to Fort Payne, versus San Diego, California, back to Fort Payne. And all I'm wanting to do is get that little uniform on and get that little hat and come home and tell how I've won the war and let the girls see me in that uniform and they'll just go crazy. God, I want to get back quick. Well, you know, I left and to hurry along and not belabor some of this stuff that you don't care about anyway. I know you're waiting to see about my drunkenness, but I go on and I'm going to get back, you know, in I think it's 8 or 9 weeks. But well, some things changed. Things changed on the scene over there, and I got back the first time in about 17 months. I didn't get back by going that early, but I went in service, and I can sum it up. And you know, we talk about we don't want to give a drunk log or blow by blow stuff, and you know, you either give a job a log or drunk a log or military log, and I'm not gonna bore you with it, but I was in the Navy 4 years and I just drank. Now see, I'd already started, and it was, as I said earlier, paramount to me. It was the main object in my life. And I started making a rating, got out of boot camp and had to wait at Great Lakes to get a ship, and got a ship that I was on the whole time I was in service, and was in Korea into some action, and when the truce was signed, I was there. But what I'm saying, I started, and we do this, you know, I started making ratings and getting a stripe, and then I'd got another one. And I was a disbursing clerk. And I didn't have to stand any watches in port or at sea. I computed pay and allowances and insurance. and all of that stuff, and I had a good deal, and I started making writings. And the first time I was late getting back was down in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I thought I'd just done the unpardonable sin. I was about an hour and 12 minutes late and got put on report. And it just broke my heart. You know, I'm a good sailor. Well, I'm going to tell you, honey, was I to know that I was going to know a lot about a lot more than putting on reports and a lot more severe stuff than that. I started making writings, and then after 2 years, they started coming off as fast as they'd gone on. I had some records, and I had this and that, and I honestly believe if I'd stayed in there much longer, that they'd had to make, I think I went in as a seaman apprentice, old Navy man Percy knows the writing, and I believe that they would have had to create a lower thing for me to get in, because I was rewriting the structure. But you know, I come out, and what do? You come out of service, it's 54. You've got the benefit of the GI Bill. What do? You know, I got so tired of that terminology that I used to hear about be somebody. God, be like so-and-so. And there's always somebody I didn't even like. But I come out of the service, and I got out on an early cut. I would have got out in October 54, but I got out in August, 2 months early. My plans were made. I know what I'm going to do. I'm coming out. I'm going to school. I'm going to college that I'd never had that aspiration to do and be somebody. Well, I get out of service, and I'm down at a... This is important in my story, because I start to get into the thing about my two sons along in a little bit. I go in this car lot where my uncle worked. And I'm going to buy me a car. I'd save a little money, had a little money, and don't ever buy a car from your uncle. Don't ever buy a car from a relative. But I go in, and I look over in that showroom, couches around in the waiting area, and God, there she was. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And I don't know why. It's unlike me. But I asked him, I said, who is that gal over there? And normally I'm in her lap. You know, I don't wait for nobody. What's introducing people? You know, I used to never smoke in my life, and I carried a lighter. I burned more women's noses. I'm there to light that cigarette. But he told me that her dad's car was being worked on. She was waiting to pick it up. And I proceeded to give her the greatest break of her life that day. God, she's not here tonight either. She could tell a story about that. But I go over there and I meet her and find out she works in an office up at a housing project. And I'm up there that afternoon and ask her out. And so, you know, college is coming up in September. That's what you're going to do. Go to school. God, I'm going to tell you, when you're in love, my eyes going around my head like a dying calf in a hailstorm. I went over and she agreed to go out, and we started to date, and we just put education and school and college on the back burner, and we began to date, and we're married, and this marriage was born two of the finest sons that any daddy in the world could ever want. I had worked in a paper mill and then got out of that and took a civil service exam and had gone to work. And some people think I make a big deal out of this, but Fort Payne at that time, there's some prefab steel and a lot of different stuff there now. There's a little industry in that little town. I don't know where it's 17,000 or 16 or what, but there's some good industry. But back then, there was hosiery manufacturing that my folks worked in, sock mills. It's called the sock mill capital. There's a sign, sock mill capital of the world, textile industry. And you either worked in the sock mill or you farmed out on one of the mountains, you know. And I took a civil service exam and went to work with the post office. And I was grateful because I went to work for the post office under an administration that wasn't of my political persuasion, and I felt real grateful. I felt real lucky. And I worked at the post office. We were married, started a family. We bought a home on a GI Bill. I got real active in organizations mainly, and I want you to hear this close. I'm not knocking. I think the JCs are a wonderful organization. But in Fort Payne at that time, I wanted to get in the JCs because the JCs were a lusty drinking crew. I mean, they drank like fish. I mean, you're going to plan events like the Northeast Alabama Potato Queen Festival. Boy, isn't that a doozy. But you can't plan that till you're over at somebody's house till about 2 or 3 in the morning with 2 or 3 fills of whiskey to really plan it, to make it come off right. And that's exactly why. See, what I did with the post office and this young family, I got a comp day, compensatory day, once a week. That was a day that a daddy could be with his wife and kids and be on a picnic or doing something with them. So I know tonight, but it's okay. You ask my kids about it, and they'll tell you it's fine. But I deprived my family of the only thing they probably wanted, a wife that wanted a husband, and two sons that wanted a daddy. Didn't deprive them of any food or any clothing or any housing. But I deprived them probably of me. And I was drinking on a good basis. And the marriage lasted. We got married in 55, and the marriage lasted till 61. My two sons were 3 and 5 when we divorced. And I've since had opportunities to ask them how much they remembered about my drinking and all then. And the one that was 5, Michael, God, he's born 55. How old is he now? 53, nearly gone. Me and him's real close. Me and Jeff, the other one, is okay. But not like me and Mike. We're uptight. We do a lot of stuff together. And they say, well, Mike remembers one time he'd got into the ball and he'd come up to Fort Payne and had a little uniform and come over to my apartment where I lived, and I don't remember that day. And, you know, that's things that we can't undo, but we do what we do and we make amends. And after that, I didn't use that to start a drunk, but a lot of times I'd be on one, and if I'm in the bar and playing that old Born to Lose and them old tearjerkers, then I'd think about the kids and add fuel to it, but not, you know, it wasn't to start, but continued to work at the post office some. God, when I left there and the annual leave that accumulated and the sick leave that accumulated, I had reached the point that if I called in to work Cecil Gilbert, and I have to use these names to make it real to me, the superintendent of mails, he'd say, "Jim, you don't have any time out. You don't have any leave, sick leave or annual." And I had an abundance, you know, that would accumulate over the time I'd been there, the years. And he said, "If you take off, it'll have to be leave without pay." And it was like, I just can't hack it. And then I reached the point that I could go into work sicker than a junkyard dog. And I worked the first class mail. And I would raise a window there and throw that mail. And I could throw that mail. The carers were excited to see me back if I'd been off, because I threw the mail right. And I was a good postal worker. My wife will tell you this. I'd always told her, but she didn't believe it coming from me. But I told her that I was a good postal clerk when I was there. You may be a good doctor. You may be a good school teacher. You may be a good carpenter. But you ain't going to be no good if you're a drunk. Now you form your own opinion and tell me I ain't got no business telling you that. See, I reached the point I thought you could play a little basketball better if you had about a half a pint. That's crap. That's just a crock. But I was a good clerk and threw the mail good and worked the mail good, but I got where I was just off too much. But we were going out of Fort Payne one day, going back after we was married, and I'm sober in the program. And my former postmaster on a Sunday afternoon was out in his yard, bent and frail and aged. And I turned around and pulled in, and I said, that's Hop Horton. And we got out and went up, and he saw who it was. And without me seeking this, he looked at my wife and he said, he's the best man I ever had. Said, he's the best clerk I ever had. Said, he just had some problems that he had to get his life straightened out. When I left, when I resigned, I wrote a letter. Listen, I can write a letter today. I wrote a letter of resignation. God, you'd thought it was come from the why. It was good. And they begged me, the superintendent of mails, assistant postmaster, the postmaster, they begged me to not do that. Said, we'll work with you. You can whip this thing. Because we already was quite aware of what my problem was. It wasn't the flu that I called in. You always calling in, y'all done it. Got the flu. They had the bourbon flu. But I knew that I needed to get out of that little old hick town. See, they was picking on me. The police car sat on Main Street in front of the bank. And I'd go out on the mountain to the bootlegger. Now listen how sick we are. I'm coming off the mountain in my car and they know my car lights from anybody else's. God, how crazy. But they did know me a lot of times because they did pick me up and I'm in jail. The greatest feeling, I think, in the world. Now, this, you think about this. I'm in a dry county, which there ain't no such thing as a dry county. It is legally wet and legally dry. There's so many bootleggers, they had to wear badges to keep them selling it to each other. But I'm coming off the mountain, and I'm winding through the back streets when I get to town. I've got me two or three pints of whiskey or whatever I've got under the seat, and I make it. They hadn't caught me, and I turn and go up my street up the hill, and I pull up in front of my apartment, and by golly, I made it. Now you get out and you go in. I mean, I don't even know that I would open and even take a drink. I'm home free. That thrill is so great that you've made it without getting caught by the police, because I got caught a lot. I could go to my mom's house, and my mother and daddy divorced, and I'd pit each one against the other, but I'd go to her house, and I wouldn't be drunk. I may have had be drunk. If I was drinking and she could smell it 10 miles away, she would call the police to come, and they'd pick me up and start to jail, and they'd say, well, Jim, you're not drunk. I said, no, I know I'm not. She just don't like me drinking. And I'd say, drop me off down at Daddy's. No, we got to take you in. And hell, I go and I'm in jail. And she don't come and appear before the judge. And have a judge the next morning say, why do you keep coming back to your mother's when you know? And then he stops because, hell, where else do you go? You ain't got nowhere to go except to mama's. I reached the point I was unemployable after I left the post office. I'd worked somewhere for a while and then quit. I'm going to tell this, and then I got to move on. I got up into Chattanooga and was going to be a vacuum cleaner salesman, Kirby Sanitronics. So I took the training for about a week or so and got my own vacuum cleaner, and it got me in an apartment. I hadn't told something here that's going to get this, but I got it, and I was ready to go out on my own, and I forgot to tell y'all that, no, I hadn't. I'd left the post office, and after after six or seven, I had a little pension coming. Well, just as I got ready to go on this vacuum cleaning selling job, got me a little apartment, the mail came and I got my check. I had a pretty nice little retirement check. I said, well, I need to go put most of this and just keep a little out in a bank. Open me up a bank at the Hamilton National Bank in Chattanooga, Tennessee. God, I think I kept about $700 or $800. I really needed that, didn't it? You know, to feed me for maybe a week or two. I kept out enough that I never did go out to sell a vacuum cleaner. They come over and picked up their machine there where I lived, you know. And I never did. I would have probably been a rousing success selling a vacuum cleaner. But anyway, that was that. And just, oh God, everything's happened. Reached the point I'd go back to my mom's, and I was ashamed to take out the garbage till after dark. See, I didn't want people to drive by and say, there's Jim back at his mama's again on her, and she's still working at a hosiery mill and getting up where she ought to have been ready to quit, but she still worked. And you know, I'm just sorry. Got in jail one time. It's when I found out about that old raw whiskey you throw down, you know, that you can't hardly keep down. And I'm in jail with a guy, and I remember his name, Alvis Dick's son. I forget his name. Was when I first got educated. You get a lot of education in jail, or you get a lot of education out on the streets, or anywhere we get. When we need it. And he told me about vanilla extract, the wonderful WB brand vanilla. And he said, if you'll get you a little 75-cent bottle of vanilla, he said, that'll stick in your stomach and you won't have to throw up like that old raw whiskey. That old white whiskey, you can't keep it down. Well, you could if you drank two or three and throw up. We've done it. I've thrown up till I could get one to stick, and then, man, I'm ready to go. But I discovered the great thing of WB vanilla. And I'm going to tell you, I could take that and drink about just that much out of the little bottle. And then I'm a sauerkraut man, not kraut juice. Kraut and cheese and crackers after that. And my stomach's that. And I could start to eat a little. Save my life. So that started being my thing that I did. It wouldn't matter if I had money to had a quart of Jack Daniels. It was WP brand. Well, I was in jail one time. My daddy come to get me out. He got me in the car and we started around the corner and down the hill to turn right. And where you want to go? Down to your mama's? Yeah. And I had about 70 cents in my pocket or so. And I said, Dad, before you go, carry me down there. And my daddy was in the ministry, and my daddy didn't use profanity. But I said, would you carry me over to old man Clark's store? Well, that was across the railroad track in the pool room. This little grocery store sold more vanilla extract than he did groceries. I mean, it's just like going to the liquor store. I mean, that's where his sales were. I said, would you take me over to Clark's? He said, what do you want to go? I said, I want to get me a bottle of chicken. He turned that corner and he squalled up tires, and this is a pastor of a church that didn't use profanity, said, hell no, I ain't going to take you over to Clark's store. And he took off and carried me down to Mother's. I get on the phone, call a taxi driver to go pick me up two or three bottles of chicken. Why didn't I ask him to go get me a pint of whiskey and bring it? He said, Jim, I'm working, I'm busy, I'll try to get in there. In a little bit he came. And that was the life I'd begun to live, and that was the thing, it was happening. And then I got an opportunity to go back to work through some help. And I went to work with the state of Alabama. I think it was $1.27 an hour. The minimum wage was about $1.25. And I'm back. And at one time, without belaboring this, I had come to you the first time in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I walked up the steps and went into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You welcomed me and you shook that hand and showed me the old ropey coffee and I stayed around you about a month, and then, you know, I knew everything, and I'm back drinking again. And so when I got this job with the highway department, I go to Montgomery, and I call you again, and you came, and I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm working with the highway department, and I got about 5 or 6 months dryness in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got an opportunity to transfer to Anniston, Alabama, and you heard about that town this morning. I've been divorced all these years, and I go to Anniston, and I'm not going to meet Carolyn on this sojourn. I'm not going to meet Carolyn at this time in my life. But I go to Anniston, and I'm going to AA, but when I get to Anniston, the first thing I ought to have done, and we know all this later, is find out immediately where the meetings are. But no, I'm working with the highway department. The guys that are married live with families and draw for them. And I'm living in the Anistonian Motel. I thought it was the Waldorf Astoria seat till I sobered up. It was a flea bag, and it's where three of us that were single lived. And you know, it's night. And you know, my meals are paid down at Seals Restaurant. I sign for my meals, and I'm with the highway department. I'm with the survey party. And it's night, and they're going to play a little cards. And any grown man can drink a couple of beers and play a little cards. And I'm not even a card player. Don't care about it. Don't know how. But I can drink a couple of beers and not have any trouble. 5 or 6 months. Drinking, not drinking, dry, not sober. Bill, here I am. I'm back in that bottle worse than I'd ever been in my life. The progressiveness of the disease of alcoholism. And I'm back in that bottle, and they're begging me to go to work. We'll cover for you out in the woods, you know. But I had to take to the bed, see. I say, I've got my bottle, and I'm drinking, and there ain't no going to work. Not for this cat. And here I am back in that thing. Now listen, this guy that owned this thing was a retired military man. And he sold whiskey bootleg. Name was Andrew Sankey. There's a Green Front State store in Alabama down there. And Lee Champion's Yellow Cab, that's three sources. And I used them all. I'd call Lee Champion the Yellow Cab and let him park a block up, because I didn't want Andrew Sankey to think I wasn't using his business. And I'd go up there and get my bottle and come back. And there I am. I'm on the drunk. Now listen to this. This is it. I call you. See, I didn't know y'all made these house calls. I might have used you before.